She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And what I'm going to ask of all of my amazing, wonderful listeners is press pause, stop what you're doing, sit down, put your headset on, and get ready to think about what we're going to talk about for this show, because it's going to be, as my mother used to say, it's going to be a Lulu, and I can't wait. Our show is made possible today due to the generous support of Habitat for Humanity. They truly do give people in our community in Tucson and in hundreds of communities around the country a hand up, not a handout. I love them for that. We thank them for their support and for all they do to make our community and our planet stronger and more sustainable. Thank you, Habitat for Humanity, and thank you, Habitat for Humanity in Tucson. The name of our show today is Campaigns for Change. Our guest is Dana Moore Fall. She is the director of advocacy for a relatively new company called Catalytic. It's a full-service advocacy and social innovation strategy firm. I'm so excited to get on with the show. Like, slow down yourself, Mrs. Green. They work across sectors to build movements, initiatives, and companies that accelerate human progress and sustainable solutions to pressing social issues. So that's the soundbite. Dana is a content-rich pistol. That's the word I came up with. I love her. She's kind of an agitator. She's so relatable to me, and she's on the side of forward motion. Let's make change happen for the greater good. And Dana, please let me read a little bit about you to kind of set the stage for your credibility. It's like instant cred when I read a little bit about this. Can you indulge
thank
me?
Thank you. No. Absolutely. Thank
most,
you.
Most guests just don't like that, but it's like you just have to get over yourself, because I would like my guests to know what you are. She has 10 Absolutely. Years experience advancing environmental campaigns at the federal, state, and local level. She is adept at grassroots coalition building from her work with, are you ready, Oxfam America, Global Exchange, and Amnesty International. And I'm going to talk about Future 500 as well. After working at the grassroots level, Dana wanted to explore ways to work within corporations in order to identify areas of potential alignment with the activist community. And I'm putting emphasis on these words because it's potential alignment that she's always looking for. As vice president of Future 500, she worked directly with some of the largest utilities and consumer brands in the country to advance market-based approaches to environmental problems. As the director of campaigns at Catalytic, she now progresses campaigns on overfishing, land conservation, and clean energy. Yes, she is all that. Dana, welcome to Mrs. Green's World.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate the introduction there.
And we did talk a little bit before we went on air, and I said to Dana, my listeners know that I am always prepared for my shows. I would think you could make the case that I am overprepared, but for this show, I didn't do it. We talked a couple of times. I really want you to share your story, because I honestly think it's one of the most important one that needs to be told, because it is about finding common ground. It is about building real coalition buildings, and it also is about some of the big 500-pound elephants in the middle of the room that are there preventing us from happening. So why don't we start with what is the overall mission of Catalytic and your role there? And then I want you to talk about Future 500, what you did there, because it really is all part of this role that you have now.
Yeah, absolutely. So Catalytic, as you said, you know, we are a consulting firm. We've been around for about 5 years. And, you know, what's really, I think, unique in industry and about us is we do really on the ground work. So we're very much in the field finding common ground and building odd bed fellow coalitions And we've been extremely successful because of our ability to not just work with environmentalists on environmental issues. There are so many groups and stakeholders and contingencies out there that we can identify and meet with to try to find common ground. And that's kind of what we do at Catalytic. And from an advocacy perspective, you know, we're always looking at how can we provide value to current movements. And so that's really where we help to come in to accelerate progress and to win. At the end of the day, that's what we all want to do. And so that's really what drove me to work with Catalytic. Before that, I was the vice president of Future 500, and that really was about building bridges in between adversaries. And we really lived that. We walked that, worked extensively with GOP stakeholders and built alliances with oil and gas and with utilities. And, you know, we really embody, and it's a great team over there led by Bill Shireman, you know, really embodies, you know, what it means to have an Odd Bedfellow Coalition. And that's really kind of the body of my work recently. As you said before that, I was in the activist community, and it was really a tough time for me when I kind of came out of that and started working within companies, and I struggled because I saw what cultural, leanings and my preconceived notions that I had about companies and about working with Republicans, and how much I had been taught this message, and how much it was inside of me that I couldn't even see opportunities that were right in front of me to build common ground. And it took me a really long time to be able to kind of shed that off me and think for myself, as you say, Gina, like really thinking for myself and not having somebody spoon feed me, you know, what I should think about what an environmentalist is. And that's really what I'm working on now.
And part of that story to me is I've had one of the other guests I had, Sipora Berman, on, who wrote a book called These
Creators.
She is freaking awesome. And she said, we have to go to the boardrooms and sit with these people. Yes, there's a place for boycotts. Yes, there's a place for picketing and having, you know, marches, but there's a place, a very important place, where you sit down from your company and I sit down from my environmental group, and we find the common ground, and we might each have 10 things we want to move forward, and together we can come up with 4 or 5 or even 3 to find what can we do, because if we just go to our corners, every time we're just going to come out fighting until someone falls to the ground, and that just kind of makes me sick. Talk a little bit about, set the stage. The reason that Dana is on the show, everybody, is because I went to Bioneers in San Rafael last October, and it was unbelievable. And I've had a number, it was like trolling for guests. I was so excited. Everywhere I went, I was saying, I got to get his card. And we're having some of those guests on. And what you were at Bioneers was a very odd duck, and yet from the group that I was in, very well received. It was not, it was a panel, and you were on, I don't remember even who all you were on with. I think Annie Leonard was there from Greenpeace, and I don't remember all the people, but it was a great panel, and I came after you, I ran after you and said, you have to be on my show because you represent the voice of reason. So talk a little bit about that. That wasn't your experience at Bioneers the year before.
That was a scary panel for me. I'm going to be totally honest, you know, and as I was going into it, I first of all, I have so much respect for Annie and you know, Amazon Watch and
right,
I mean,
Amazon I, Watch, I, that's right. Leah was there, yes.
Yes, it was an amazing panel, and then also B Corp was on, and we were trying to talk about good cop, bad cop tactics to, you know, companies, kind of the inside-outside strategy, and it was difficult for me because I think, you know, it's really one thing for us to say we want to build common ground, but, you know, what does that actually mean? You know, when you really get into the muck of it and when you really sit down and have those conversations, it gets icky. And, you know, we don't agree on probably 9 out of 10 things, you know, sometimes. It's that one thing that is that star that you can follow. And I focus on the one, whereas I think a lot of times we get stuck on the 9.
Right.
You know, it's an impediment to us to be able to see where that common ground is. And so, you know, when I was asked to go onto that panel, I really hesitated because I wanted to make sure that I came with a clear message that, you know, just because you're able to reach across doesn't mean that means that you're a traitor or that you're, you know, greedy or
you sold
you know,
out.
We tend to, exactly. We tend to get into these words hang over us like clouds. And I think as especially people who are working to try to save the planet, you know, it's really important for us to show our value and to show that we're creating progress and moving. But the majority of the time you're stuck in the muck, really just trying to fight through one small thing every day. And it's really, really overwhelming. And we all want those big wins, but really it's most of the time just trying to warm relationships with people that don't agree with you. And that's the hard work. That's the everyday work. But I was really excited about that panel, and we've gotten good feedback, and I think that it went really well, and I have so much respect for everybody that was on it. And I'm really glad you came up to me afterwards.
I mean, it really did. It was a very moving panel. And what was interesting to me, it was towards the end of the day, and nobody was leaving. Nobody was walking out.
Yeah.
It was a packed house. It was a big room, and people really were there to hear what was going on and what some of the challenges are. So, but talk. Can you give us one example when you talk about Future 500? And I don't remember the details because it was really a long time ago. Of when, and I love that when there's a dog barking in the background.
It's sorry, like, about that.
This is what makes Mrs. Green's world real. We have dogs, people. They bark. We have children. They cry. This is not NPR, and that's okay. We love NPR. But anyway, so
thank you for understanding.
No, it's
I got
like,
two pit bulls in
this really,
two pit bulls in two different rooms.
It's like, okay, so welcome to Mrs. Green's real world is what I want to say. So, okay, so there was an example of, you know, we talk about the Republicans and the Democrats, and to me it's one of the saddest things that ever happened in our country, where it has gotten polarized in the press that it's, if you're an environmentalist, you're a Democrat. If you're a Republican, you're anti-climate change and all that. That's crap. That's just crap. That's not true. So you gave an example, I believe, of a major, big mover and changer who asked your opinion about how to tell a senator to vote on a very important bill that involves something with climate change. And I mean, I'm probably killing this story, but you can pull an example from your repertoire of where the voice of reason and the facts mattered to really make a vote in favor of the environment.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. There's it's interesting because as I've gone through, especially working more within companies and kind of this odd bedfellow outreach, there's been so many examples of times where common ground was on the table and both sides just couldn't see past it. And this was an example where, you know, we have a huge oil and gas company that supports a policy like a price on carbon or a carbon tax. And a coalition of NGOs who are obviously interested in the price on carbon. I don't think you can ask any environmentalist who's not interested in that. And they couldn't seem to get beyond the fact that they were, that one was an oil and gas company and made money off of selling energy and selling energy that was carbon intensive. And it was a really sad situation because we had an opportunity to put something on the table that could have been real. And I struggled with it because I was so shocked by the fact that the majority of the coalition wouldn't work with us because we were taking funding and working with this company. And, you know, this kind of goes into the holy test, and we've talked a little bit about this, but, you know, there's this holy test that you have to go through as an environmentalist often within the community where the first question is, do you take corporate funding?
Right,
and
right.
Okay, if you take corporate funding, okay, is it Patagonia? and okay, good, check, you're holy. You got the holy test.
Right, right, right.
And, you know, I never have passed the holy test, and I'm actually okay with that because I don't think being pure is going to get us where we need to be. You know, there was a couple of organizations, I have to say, and you know, Sapporo is a perfect example. Greenpeace, they're amazing because the way that they do things is we don't have permanent friends and we don't have permanent enemies. And I think that's a really important thing for
it.
Us
I
as a community
to
do.
I have to write that down. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, and they were, you know, they're some of the few that will really come to the table and actually work with some of what we call these demon companies. Now, they will bludgeon them before they do so.
Right.
But they know the time to stop bludgeoning to death and actually work with. And, you know, I think that still to this day, we continue to bludgeon this company. And I understand, you know, why at some points we have to draw a line in the sand. But it shouldn't matter the reason that a company is working with you. If a company is working with you because they want to undermine their competitor or because they want to build a new platform for their market or whatever reason it is that a company is working with me, I don't care. What I care about is the environmental outcome. And if a company is going to work with me, especially one of the biggest oil and gas companies in the world, to pass a carbon tax, I'm going to work with them.
Right.
And I know that's not everybody's perspective, but I do think that we have to get over this, you know, holier than thou reason why you're working with me, or else nobody's going to work with us except for the people that agree with us. And as we now know, that does not work to actually create systemic change.
And it just polarizes people. And what good, to what end? Nobody wins in that situation. And I always think about what is the intention, which is you bring up a lot. It's the best interest for the environment. And sometimes that's going to mean there's really give and take on both sides. And this is the most important issue we decided on the 10. So we're going to go with that one and figure out how we can move it forward. You know, I was telling you, speaking of utility companies, last night, it's so perfect for the timing of this interview. I was at a meeting. It's like, I wish it was all videotaped because it was the quintessence of what's right about parties coming together. It was Tucson Electric Power, which is our big utility company that's going for a rate case. You know, we're going to have a lot of going on in the next one to two years. And it was the biggest, most respected solar company. It's actually a nonprofit. It's a guy named Kevin Cook from Technicians for Sustainability and a group of citizens. And I want to say informed citizens. People came there. We filled the room with people that really had some, I was like holding my breath saying, man, I hope this all goes civil. And it was. And part of it is because Kevin Cook, who is a rabid environmentalist, who has a major, major investment in solar and why there's everything right, he sits down at the table time after time after time with TEP and finds common ground. You know what I mean? He doesn't make us pass the litmus test or the holy test.
Right.
He finds common ground. And TEP afterward thanked me. And it wasn't me. It's a group of us that put these sustainability series together for having intentional, informative, important conversations. And that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, right. And those are the stories that, you know, those are the stories that we should really be telling. I mean, the other thing I think that I struggle with, and this is something that especially over the past, I would say, 2 to 3 years, I've really been doing soul searching around, is what type of environmentalist I am and what type of environmentalist I want to be. And one of the things that really has been difficult for me is the fact that there really isn't a positive environmental vision that I can attach myself to. I'm 33 years old. You know, I'm looking to be in this game for as long as possible. And, you know, I want to have a positive environmental vision. And right now, you know, like the other day, I opened up Twitter and I follow mainly environmental groups and CSR folks. And it is depressing. and that doesn't mean that I expect us to say, oh, everything's hunky-dory. Like, I mean, I know the planet is dying. Like, I am aware of that every single moment of every single thing that I do, you know, and I feel like it just becomes so overwhelming and depressing where I just want to hear, you know, what are we doing right? What's working? And every time that I find something that's working, it's a time when there have been diverse voices at the table, and when we have looked at it from a systemic perspective. And, you know, the Great Bear Rainforest is, you know, a perfect example of this. And, you know, that's environmentalists obviously fighting for 15 years, but working eventually with forestry companies and timber companies. You know, you couldn't have had that deal without timber companies. And so that doesn't mean that we don't have to be hard on bad actors in the marketplace. But I do think that I'm really interested in a positive story like the one that you just told, because that's what gets me going. That's what gets me up every day and said, I can actually do something that's going to make tangible change, as opposed to the problem is so overwhelming that I can't even open my eyes, right? And that's where I get really, really lost sometimes.
And it can shut you
in
down.
In the environmental movement.
Yes.
It does.
It can shut you down.
You know, I'm sure
it
people
really
deal
can.
With depression.
Yeah, I can tell you that the Green Team does. It's so overwhelming at times that you have to find those rays of hope And the ray of hope that I want to have for you right now is that we are already up on our first break. So no worries about me not over-preparing for the show. We're going to take a very, very short break and hear more from Dana Moore Fall, who is just all that. Dana, we'll be right back.
Join us for a new Mrs. Green's World episode every Saturday at 12 noon Pacific Time at MrsGreensWorld.com. All of our past shows are available as on-demand podcasts at MrsGreensWorld.com. Listen on your computer or mobile device using the iHeartRadio app. Connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. We are a proud member of the Dream Vision 7, Glimmerglass, Green Radio Divas, Blog Talk, and Speak Up Radio Networks. If you have questions or comments about the show, write to us at info@MrsGreensWorld.com. We'd love to hear from you. And now, more with Mrs. Green.
Welcome back, everybody. Thanks for being with us. Just another quick shout out to thank Habitat for Humanity Tucson for their support of the Mrs. Green's World mission and vision. The name of our show today is Campaigns for Change. Please join me in welcoming back our guest for this hour, Dana Moore Fall, the Director of Advocacy for the Service Advocacy and Social Innovation Strategy Firm, Catalytic. Dana has more than 10 years' experience advancing environmental campaigns at every level, the federal, state, and local level. She is truly adept at grassroots coalition building from her work at Oxfam America, Global Exchange, and Amnesty International. And in the past, Dana has worked directly with some of the largest utilities and consumer brands in the country to advance market-based approaches and solutions to environmental problems. Dana, thanks again for being with us. And let's pick up on the holy test. Let's continue with that because it's so important. And if you just joined the broadcast, this is about how do we build consensus? How do we build bridges with adversaries? It's also about asking yourself the question, what type of environmentalist do I want to be? And my answer to that is, it's complicated. It's not aligning with a party or one organization. It's about my tagline. We don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. So when you're asking this yourself, what kind of environmentalist do I want to be? It might be that you're a real believer and a financial supporter of and a rallying cry for X organization. Let's just pick the Nature Conservancy, which I happen to adore. There might be times when they take a stand that you're saying, well, I wish this would change a little bit. So it's that kind of thinking that we're talking about. So, Dana, do you want to segue into like the corporate funding piece? Because you sent me a copy of a letter, and I don't know if that's the perfect example, where stakeholders are no longer invited to the party. It's like, we're uninviting you. And tell us a little bit about how that happens.
Yeah, you know, it's happened to me several times. And so now, you know, I think as you go through it so many times, it starts to not hurt as much. But, you know, I just so the audience knows, to give it a bit of context, I'd forwarded on an email that I had sent a while ago to a coalition of environmental groups who had disinvited myself as well as another organization from a conversation around recycling policy. And, you know, it was really difficult because we had been working on the issue for 5 years. Recycling policy, plastic pollution is something that actually I want to have a huge win, you know, in my lifetime. I want to see that really move the needle on that. And we had been working on the issue for a while. And what was interesting is we had been blackballed by both sides. So when we started working on the issue, at least it's fair. At least it's fair, discrimination. So when we started working on the issue, we went to some of the biggest trade associations in the country. And one of them said to us, you know, we will not work with you if you continue to pursue this policy. And oh, by the way, all of our members, which was, you know, huge, big consumer brand companies, will also not work with you. And, you know, because we are who we are, we said, well, too bad, we're going to continue working on it. And it did end up, their promise did really follow through, and several companies wouldn't work with us after that. And so, you know, over that time,
so
we started building.
It's blackballing. Is that, it's blackballing.
Oh, yeah.
And bullying somehow. It feels a little like bullying. So go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm sure that there's college, or, you know, I'm sure some of your audience members have experienced this where it's like, you know, you go and try to engage with somebody and they basically say, we're going to blackball you. This happens all the time in D.C., right?
Right.
And this was actually in D.C., funny enough. And so we started pursuing an NGO coalition and started reaching out to different, you know, communities, all of which were trying to advance the same outcome. And we started aligning ourselves with a couple of big NGOs. And one of the NGOs was taking corporate funding, and we were working with them. And as the meeting came up, which, by the way, we were on the steering committee, on the planning committee, we received...
Me. You can't make this up.
And this has happened to me. I can't even tell you how many times, and I swear I know there's an audience member out there right now that's like, oh, this has happened to me. You know, we received word that we were invited. We had just been disinvited. And at the time, it was really painful because I was like, man, I've been working on this for 5 years on a shoestring budget with no support. And, you know, nobody had even the decency to pick up the phone and call us and say, you know, why do you take corporate funding? Or what are you doing with the corporate funding? Or who is it that you're working with, you know, within an industry? And what are their goals? Nobody. It was just, we're disinviting you. And you know, the organizer, to his credit, was amazing about it. And I have so much respect for the organization. And he really did try to broker this conflict. But we're talking about a conflict amongst people who 99% agree. So if we 99% agree and you can't even give us a seat at the table, what does this mean for the people that don't agree with us even 1%?
And the result, you know, was stop plastic pollution from getting into the marine environments. If you're against that, raise your hand, and I'm inviting you to leave the building. It's like, come on. Who wants plastic to go into our oceans? So, I mean, that's it infuriated
me.
But go ahead. I can't imagine how you felt.
Yeah, I felt just really, you know, it is really hurtful. And I think, again, this is that holy test and that litmus test. And it makes us all really afraid to be the type of environmentalist or the whatever you want to call yourselves within the network. And I mean, and that's what's scary to me is I agree with 99%, you know, and I think we all actually really do believe, you know, agree in most cases. And, you know, so does that mean that I can't say that I like to hunt? Does that mean I can't say I like to, you know, go and drive, you know, race cars? Does that mean I can't be who I want to be? I can't go fishing and kill a fish? And, like, you know, what does that actually mean, this litmus test? And so,
right. What does,
you know,
it mean
one of the biggest
pure
things is,
yeah,
corporate funding. Yeah,
right.
What's the purity,
right,
test? And the corporate funding piece, I think, is the biggest one that hinders us because, you know, as we were talking about earlier, when I'm able to get money from a corporation, I am much more likely to get them to listen to me. It's like human nature, right? If somebody's,
yes,
if you're paying somebody,
yes,
right,
I value your
opinion.
You advice, yes, yes.
And I'm paying you for that opinion. And so I'm not saying that every organization should do this. I think that we all have our different place in the ecosystem. And, you know, there's groups who don't take corporate funding, and I think that's great. But don't undermine the ones that do and are able to be effective by being able to sit in those boardrooms.
And it depends
and
on what
so
they're
many
doing.
Times.
Yeah. I don't mean to,
yeah,
interrupt, but I mean, you and I knew this was going to happen. It depends on what they're doing. Because one of my favorite groups, to be honest, is the Environmental Working Group. And to me, they are never, in my view, tainted because they don't take corporate funding because of what they do. They can't. They can't afford to because people will then use that against them. But many other organizations wouldn't be around to do the work they did and continue to do if they didn't have corporate sponsors, because that's where a lot of the money is. Microsoft is a corporation, people. So's Apple, and so's Google. And they're not all green, and they're not all doing great stuff, but they collectively look at those three organizations and what they do to move millions for the greater good. So that's
absolutely,
that's my little Mrs. Green rant. It's like, come on,
no,
people.
And it's
not all dirty
true
money.
Well, and, you know, and there's been times where, you know, and I think this is what, you know, Annie brought up on the panel is, like, it depends on what you're doing with the money, like you just said. And there's been times where we've gotten corporate funding. I've worked with a corporation that I got to a point and said, all right, you're not really interested in engaging. And that's when you walk away. But yes, what's great about that is that that small period of time that you were internal, you were able to, one, identify areas of pressure that you can then help for the outside strategy, you know, when not confidential, because of course we don't want to share confidential information. And two, you are able to identify internal advocates that then you can work with behind the scenes. And those internal advocates are waiting for you. They're just dying for somebody to come in and say the things that they want to say that they can't say politically. And that is so, so important for an outside campaign strategy. So you need the inside for the outside. And the sooner that we are able to do that in an orchestrated, concerted strategic way, the more effective we're going to be on a global scale.
And an example of that is some of the greatest policy that's ever been brought into law in our world, in our country, is when Democrats and Republicans sat down and worked ethically, morally, and for the greater good to get some things passed. It can happen. Mm-hmm. And they didn't do it by saying, no, you're a Republican, I'm a Democrat. I mean, this is, of course, going a little bit farther into the past from where I sit. There hasn't been a lot of that these days. But in the past, you were proud to be part of a two-party system because there was some greater good in there. So what happened with this coalition? So you were with Future 500. You got voted off the island by both groups. What happened with that? Other than you're writing great letter.
I mean, you know, it just kind of made me, I think it was a good experience, at least for me personally. I think we all go through points in our career where we go, oh, and the light comes on. And, you know, it was great for me because I think that, again, it, you know, when you come in, especially as a young environmentalist, you're so wide-eyed and you're like, oh, I'm going to save the planet. And, you know, all environmentalists do good. And all environmentalists don't do good. I mean, you know, we are all humans. I mean, we're trying to do the best we can, but there's times when we vote our own tribes off of the island, and it doesn't make any sense. I mean, look at what happened to EDF. Let's just be honest. I mean, there was a campaign to undermine EDF. I mean, I'm not saying that everything EDF does is perfect.
And tell everybody what EDF is. Tell Environmental Defense Fund.
Environmental Defense Fund, and I don't know if some people saw this, but there was a campaign by a small activist group, and I have to pull up who it was, but that did a kind of a smear campaign against EDF, and what their main point was greenwashing, and you're working with companies, and you're helping companies when you really should be fighting against them, and you know, and I can understand that, but that's not EDF's role, and EDF has never said that their role is to, you know, propel off the front of Microsoft building. I mean, their role is to go in and work with Microsoft, and that's okay because they need Greenpeace to be propelling at the same time while they're inside. They should be watching them propel.
Yes, you know, that's exactly right.
But,
great example.
So, you know, we did that to EDF, and I just think that that's not right. I don't, you know, if we can't even work with EDF, I mean, how do you expect to work with INHOF? I mean, it's not going to work for you.
Like, come on, people.
It's very bizarre.
I know,
bizarre
it is very bizarre.
And it's not right.
No,
it
isn't
right. And we don't stand up for each other, and we need to, because this whole holier-than-thou thing isn't going to get us anywhere.
Right. This week, there's a campaign from Big Ag to smear Environmental Working Group. Well, I look at that as someone that I really do think looks at a lot of both sides of issues. And it says, you know, they shouldn't be having corporate money, and they're not, but Big Ag is coming. And it's like, that's predictable. It's okay. They say a lot of things that are a threat to Big Ag. It's okay. But let's go on this little greenwashing is an opportunity, according to you. It's not a threat. It's an opportunity. So talk about that. Why do you think greenwashing is an opportunity?
I think because it's a public declaration. So the reason that, you know, and this is really, really critical, you know, is that when a company says something publicly, it means something. It means that they are now beholden to that statement. And that's why it's so difficult to get any companies to sign on to anything, as we all know.
Right.
Because their lawyers have to go over it with a fine, you know, tooth comb, and they have to look at every single
word. 8 to 9 lawyers, what can I say? Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So when they say something publicly, like, you know, we support X policy, to me, that's a gift. And because if, you know, we saw this on recycling a lot, where companies would say, we're going to be 50%, you know, recycling, 100%, you know, PET recycled by 2020. And they're like at like 5%, and they have no plan in effect as to how they're going to do it. I look at that and I go, yes. Because that means that then I can go back and say, well, you said this in The Guardian that you were going to do it, or this is on your website. I mean, how do you intend to do that? And then you can hold them to that greenwashing. And, you know, it doesn't mean that greenwashing is good. I'm not advocating for that, but I think it's an opportunity for us, you know, to get companies to engage and to be transparent about the commitments that they make. And I would rather hold them to that than, you know, have to play games with them behind the scenes.
And the hit I get from what you said, it goes back to the same thing. Just because they said it and you read it on their website doesn't make it true. I have a perfect example of why it's an opportunity, and it's Eileen Fisher. I'm really been high on Filthy Fashion, and I had their head of sustainability, Amy, on my show for what they're doing to try to become a leader in sustainable fashion, fair trade, all of those things. And Amy said, we set out with these goals. Eileen Fisher herself said, we're going to do this by 2020. And she said, and Gina, we can't. They're saying it. We can't. And it's exactly what you said. We wanted that. It was the vision. We believed we could get there. And we're like, I think they're like 4 or 5 years in. We can't. And she told us why. And any reasonable, rational thinking human being would say, oh, I get it. It's complicated. They can't get the workforce here. I mean, there's a lot of issues when you're talking about bringing production from where 90% of it is done overseas in less than acceptable conditions to bringing it all home. I got news for you folks. It's not going to happen anytime soon. There's too many complicated pieces of it. And I thought, here is a woman of true integrity saying, we're going to have to re-look at those numbers and really go out longer and try to keep developing solutions. But they weren't trying to greenwash. They set these laudable goals, and they realized very early on in the first, you know, 3 to 4 years of trying to reach them, it wasn't attainable. Well, there's a lot of integrity in me when a company says, you know what, we said that, but we can't do it. And that's what you're talking about.
Yeah, and that's an even better opportunity when they say that they make a commitment and they can't because of the market. I actually think that's a bigger opportunity, because now Eileen Fisher is at the table trying to solve the systemic problem.
Yes.
As opposed to just saying, we're only going to solve what's good for our company and we're going to figure it out. Now they're saying, we basically cannot based on supply. And so therefore, let's get a coalition of other people in industry to solve the systemic problem of this issue, which is what you really want. You want to trade up. You know, you want to say, okay, ExxonMobil, we don't agree with your past, you know, climate, you know, PR, and I know there's a huge campaign against Exxon right now. You know, okay, fine, great. We don't agree with that. We are not in the same place. But where we do agree with you is on our carbon tax. And you said it publicly that you support a carbon tax. Great. Rex, let's work on that. You know, trade up. I mean, that's the systemic approach. Is it more important for us to bludgeon to death one company that is one tiny, tiny, tiny piece of the big pie?
Right.
No, I want the systemic problem solved. And that is a price on carbon. So we need to just always, always be trading up, as opposed to just being holy and staying, you know, ideologically rigid because we don't want to work with a company that we deem bad, right?
Bad actor. Yes. And I think there's always, with that, what makes me smile is that you always have to be allowed, even in your voice of reason, and I'm talking about me and my absolute philosophy of create a positive vision, how can we move things forward? Everybody's allowed the one company that they can bash unconditionally. We all have one. And mine, of course, is Monsanto. And I've had people on the show defend some of the things they've done. And it's like, okay, that's fine for you. I respect your opinion. I'm glad you voiced it on the air, but I don't have to be in the Monsanto fan club. So I think we all get
absolutely
to have that
not
one company that we say, yeah, I believe in all that for everybody else, but for this one, I have to have one that I can just, you know, bash unconditionally and freely.
Absolutely.
So we're going to come up on the next break here very quickly. And what I'd like to think about in 30 seconds that we have for this break is, you really are all about a positive vision. How can we grow as a movement with a positive vision? How can we work more together? One of my biggest frustrations, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, there are still the silos. There's the water people and the energy people and the food people and the fashion people. If we ever got together, not would we change the world, just by getting together, the world would change. So some of your thoughts, being the agitator and the all of the good things that I want to say about you, the visionary, a thought leader for change, how can we get there? Let's talk about positive vision and working together. Everybody stay with me. More from Dana Moore Fall as soon as we get back. You will not be sorry. Stay here with us.
Mrs. Green's World's mission is to preserve the planet by creating a global community of people who care about the health of the Earth. We educate, inform, and inspire. Mrs. Green's World is an independent, non-political, agenda-free voice. Your generous gift enables all of us to explore the issues facing the health of the planet in a comprehensive way. As a Mrs. Green's World sustainer, you can assist us in offering trusted information, providing listeners with the tools to make their own conclusions and choose their own steps to create a healthier planet. Visit MrsGreensWorld.com and click on Become a Member today.
Welcome back, everybody, and thanks for joining us. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And I'm sure all of you have your thinking caps on steroids, so to speak, because of this great, lively, and to me, very exciting and positive discussion we're having with Dana Moore Fall, who is the Director of Advocacy for the Service Advocacy and Social Innovation Strategy firm Catalytic. The name of the show is Campaigns for Change. And I just want to say for a minute, because my team asked me to, a lot of our sustainers ask me to, my call to action for our listeners is think of us as the NPR of Green. Think of us as a member-supported organization and consider becoming a Mrs. Green's World sustainer. Our goal is to have 1,000 people contribute $100 a year, which is $8.34 a month. And that will help us go and grow and continue to provide quality broadcasting and a lot of other wonderful things, all on behalf of Mother Earth and making the world a healthier, safer place for all of us. So that's my little reach out to my listeners. Press pause and consider supporting our work. So a little bit more about Dana is she has a lot of experience, over 10 years, advancing environmental campaigns at the federal, state, and local level. That's the sound bite, but the real deal is this woman is dedicated to finding common ground to help move us forward for a healthier planet in every way. So that's the Mrs. Green version. She's a thought leader. Like I said, agitator to me is such a good word and a stand for positive change. So Dana, let's go. Talk about a positive vision so that I don't get off shows. I put my head down sometime, as does Mr. Green, and we say, let's go, charge up all our charge cards, leave the house, go on the journey around the world, because there is no hope. You know, it doesn't last very long, but you know how that can happen.
Oh, gosh, I've been thinking about this a lot, and I wish I had a silver bullet.
I'd be there with you, helping to aim it.
I know. I think there's some tactical things that we can focus on, which, again, is always telling the story, the positive story, as much as we tell the negative story. I think that would be at least a small thing that we can do. So, you know, if you're a big nonprofit and every time you tweet, you know, something that is depressing, like polar bears, you know, extremely emaciated and dying, and these pictures that we see every single day that just stay with us. And if you could tweet, the next tweet would be a positive thing, like what happened in Great Bear, or what you just talked about last night. I mean, these are wins that are happening every single day that we don't discuss as much as we should. And I think just by discussing them, we can also learn and replicate them.
Right.
And so to me, that's just such a basic fundamental thing, just to help us to get a little bit out of this overwhelming.
The sky is falling. We're doomed. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, that's just based, and it's so enemy-driven, too. I mean, so I think, one, it's just as much positive as negative, if possible. Not at all saying that we're gonna try to sugarcoat things, and that's not at all what I mean, but just some balance. I mean, we see this in regular media as well. You turn on the news, you know, 5 o'clock, and I mean, it's depressing, you know, and it would be nice to have some balance. So that could be a start. You know, I think the next thing would be, again, trying to replicate those lessons and sharing that with each other. I think because, you know, we don't want to admit this as an environmental community, but we fight over funding, you know?
Yes, and yes, that's absolutely the positive truth.
It is the absolute truth. And, you know, I have so much respect for the foundation community, but I think there is ways that they can help to alleviate that tension and that competitiveness. And you know, that's where you get these angry kind of relationships in between small grassroots groups and big NGOs that get a lot of the foundation funding, and there's this feeling of inequality. And, you know, I think if we could find a way to have a better conversation about sharing of funds, you know, I think that would be helpful, because then we don't compete in such a negative way. I think that would be another small thing that we can do. And it would be great if the foundation community would be interested in that conversation, because I think they don't realize sometimes how toxic it gets on our end.
You know, let's just press pause here for a minute, because like what happened to me, my insides were doing cartwheels, because when you talk about a possible solution, funders could demand change. They could say, we want you to come to us, three big organizations, and talk to us about how you're going to work together to bring about X, and to really be the leaders for systemic change, because they're giving the money. You know, when you're the little guy like Mrs. Green's World, who is, you know, has a nonprofit, try to get into a big foundation. It's kind of like, I double dog dare you. It's not happening, because we're not the big dogs. And to me, all of that out of the conversation, if I, you know, had all the money in the world and the funding for our organization, what I feel happens is it shuts down the opportunity for creative, innovative changes, because it's, I'm doing the same thing. This is my mission. This is what our organization does. And the working together, when you get people together to create, new solutions can come up that you never thought of, because you're using the collective wisdom. So I love that. I'm going to quote you on that. How can foundations lead us to work together?
Yeah, and you know, and I know that they're trying, and I see how, you know, when you go to a foundation and you're partnering with somebody else, they tend to really like that. I mean, there is an incentive to partner, but I think that from the more systems-wide approach, it has become, I think, a very... I think it's become a little bit toxic, and I can't quite put my finger on what it is. And I think those that have been, you know, looking for foundation funding and have been working with foundations long enough kind of probably intuitively know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
So it's, I don't know what that answer is yet, but I think it's something that we should pursue as a community.
And even
so I think
we're
the positive
question.
Balance.
Yes. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just
open it up.
Do you think that you'll ever have an assessment, or what is your assessment of how do we get some of these conversations out of the political arena? Are people getting there a little bit more? Because it really, to me, the environment should not be aligned with a party. It should be one of the things where there is common ground, because we all live on this planet. We all eat the food. We all breathe the air. We all drink the water. There is inherent common ground. So how do you feel about which way the political conversation is heading?
Oh, that's a really hard one. I mean,
it's really hard.
I mean, as
one.
With
love to know
as
what
with
you
anything.
Think. It's a
I
tough
mean,
one.
Oh, God. I mean, as with anything, I honestly believe that the 5% on both ends take hostage the 90% in the middle.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's just the way it is. for a long time at Future 500, we were talking about trying to do a radical middle movement. And, you know, how do you really talk about the moderate, you know, portion of society, which is the majority of society? You talk to the average Joe Schmo, you know, they care about this. And it doesn't matter what their background is. The majority of my family is Christian Republicans. And when I talk to them about this, they care about this, you know. So it's
great,
not a political
point.
Issue. I think
great point.
Yeah. Yeah, it's more just a messaging issue, and it's more a drama. I mean, as we see what's playing out now, I mean, drama sells, and what's told. You know, that's a story that's told. But that's okay, because, you know, that's human nature, and that's where we're going. But I think that as a community, as the environmental community, we have to find a moderate way for us to at least understand and empathize with, you know, the other side of the island. And this goes back to what I talked about earlier about the holy test, because if you try to put a Southern Republican hunter, you know, I mean, through the holy test, you know, they're not going to make it through. But, you know, but they have the same outcome. They want the same outcome as you. They want to protect this area to be able to hunt in it. And so does it matter that they want to protect it to kill something and eat it, and you want to protect it because you think that it's pristine and beautiful and should be protected because of all the reasons we care as an environmental group? Does it matter? And I think that is the underlying question we all have to ask ourselves. And the problem right now is most of the time it does matter. And to me, it doesn't matter to me. I care about the outcome. It doesn't have a positive environmental outcome. You know, we work on fishing issues, and I sit down with recreational fishermen who are there because they want to kill a fish and eat it. And you know, I work, there's a group called Bloody Decks. I mean, you know, it's about killing fish and eating them.
What a life.
And I'm okay with that, because yes, I want there to be more fish for them to kill and eat. We have to look at, you know, what's the reason. I mean, I'm okay with protecting a habitat, you know, because I want to protect it for environmental reasons. But if that means that that's partnering with the recreational fishing community, who is doing it because they want more fish to be able to catch and kill, we're on the same page. We both want to protect habitat. It's just for different reasons. Does that mean we shouldn't work together? I would actually say I want to work with them, because they're going to reach people that I can't reach as a messenger.
Yes.
And that's extremely important.
Yes. All the more reason why we need to work together, because what matters is that there are still fish. And if it's overfished, there won't be. Everybody loses. And if we, yep, if there's too many, that upsets the system as well, the natural system. So there's, and hunting is a perfect example. I mean, look at places like New Jersey, where deer have overcome neighborhoods. They're a safety issue because of driving and traffic. And, you know, hunters help that. If they're, you know, my brother's a hunter, and he eats what he kills. That's what he does. He likes to hunt, and he goes and eats it, kills it and eats it, and he cares deeply about the environment. So it's a perfect example. What about the, do you have an example of a case where people did work together for the common good, and they did set aside the differences and found what was right, and something really important moved forward in a spirit of cooperation?
Yeah, I mean, I think your example last night was a great one.
It was.
You know, there's been other, yeah, it really was. I mean, and you see that a lot in utilities right now. You know, I think that because there really is a transition, and we're seeing that, especially with, you know, transitioning the natural gas to solar and wind and other sustainable technologies. But, you know, forestry has done great work recently, and I have to give a shout out to a lot of the forests campaigners that have been able to really drive supply chain transparency and increase, you know, sustainable practices. Asia Pulp and Paper, which, you know, is the second largest pulp and paper company in the world. They're based in Indonesia. Perfect example of, you know, a company who was targeted by Greenpeace and others to had the majority or a good amount of their customers, big brands, deselected them as a supplier because they were, you know, doing a lot of deforestation and they weren't being a good actor in the marketplace. And because of that market driver, they were able to say, well, because this is affecting our bottom line, I mean, let's be honest why they did it at first. that we need to change. And now they've turned into a company that actually has sustainability as a pillar for what they do.
Oh my gosh.
And
Asia Pulp,
you know, and
paper.
We're talking about Asia Pulp and Paper. We're talking about a huge paper pulp and company in Indonesia. And Indonesia has a flurry of complex issues, including fire and wildfires. And that is a huge complex issue. But, you know, Greenpeace was one that said, again, it goes back to, we don't have any permanent enemies. We don't have any permanent friends. And they were able to work with the company and not take actually corporate funding for it, but able to work with them to become a good actor. And now they're, you know, a leader on this. And I think that's an amazing example.
That's
and
a palm great
oil,
example.
You know,
really
well.
Great example.
Yeah,
it really helps.
Yeah.
It matters a whole heck of a lot. And what's your report card? We only have about 3 minutes left, maybe even 2.5, I don't know, about the oceans, because that is one of the areas of specialty for you. Do you see things getting better? I think I do. I'm on an international board for SATO, which is focusing on the Sea of Cortez.
Oh, great.
And it's a microcosm of what's going on in the world, because it's a big body of water, relatively, you know, that all kinds of ecosystems exist. And they're very dependent on fishing for the livelihood of all of the people that live, you know, around the Sea of Cortez. And there's progress there. There's, you know, whereas fishing habitats were devastated and destroyed, they're being restored. And we're working with the community to find alternative things to do to bring revenue to the family, income, you know, eco-villages and all that stuff. So is it working a little bit, some of these organizations, these big organizations like Oceana and Waterkeeper Alliance, some good stuff?
Yeah, oh my gosh, there's so much good stuff going on in oceans. It's actually really exciting right now. You know, huge groups, I think Oceana, you're right, is a great group on this. You know, Pew Charitable Trust is doing amazing work, as well as Ocean Conservancy and others. You know, what I've really seen is some, like you said, some really great small wins. For example, in California and along the West Coast, we've had some great wins on forage fish recently, which is obviously, you know, the reason. I mean, we need forage fish, and it's extremely important. Drift gill nets is another one that has had some really great wins. And that's been because, again, it always goes back to working with other communities like fishermen.
Absolutely.
And, you know, not demonizing them. Yeah, not demonizing them and saying, you're taking too much fish. It's how can you take fish correctly? What are the technologies that you need, like deep set buoy gear, to be targeted about how you catch swordfish so there's no bycatch? It's like, these are the conversations, you know, rigs to reefs. You know, how can we use these old oil rigs to actually create habitat? I mean, these are opportunities where it's such an odd bedfellow, you know, opportunity that it's just perfect.
I know.
The stranger it is, the better.
Yes, it's really, really unbelievable. So, well, I'm going to have to wrap up the show. I know that my listeners, my tribe, my friends will say this is one of those ones that was an hour and it felt like 5 minutes. And it's because of your passion, the fire in your belly, and being such an advocate for the planet and for change and working together. It was great to interview you. Thanks for taking the time. We'll certainly spread the word. Everybody, next Tuesday, John Wordis, executive chef from Caridad Community Kitchen and the Community Food Bank. Amazing. And then on May 14th, our national show, the Dean of the College of Science at the University of Arizona, Dr. Joaquin Ruiz, another thought leader. Make it a great green week, everybody. And thanks for being a part of Mrs. Green's World.